You know, the view from here is really good. It's like the best seat of the house, so I guess that's why Kate and Michael always sit here. Yeah, I hope you all get a chance to sit in the seat sometime, because it's like looking at a field of sunflowers. As opposed to a white wall, it's pretty great. So, anyway. Is it on? Is that what you're asking?
You pushed it, I think.
Did you?
The light, red light is on. Is that a good sign? Okay. Yes, very good. Ha! If you don't understand the way right before you, how will you know the path as you walk? Progress is not a matter of near or far, but if you are confused, mountains and rivers block your way. These are words from The Harmony of Difference and Equality, and they seem very appropriate to me for this Way-Seeking Mind talk that I'm giving, which is a talk about how I came to be sitting here in this cushion. And of course, it's kind of ironic and also appropriate that I'm here right now doing this talk, because this is a moment when my inner compass in the last few weeks has been fluctuating madly, and my inner GPS has always been a little wonky, of a terrible sense of direction. I get lost everywhere. As soon as I walk out my door, I go the wrong way. But I've just come through kind of a pretty brutal bout of indecision. I think probably everybody experiences excruciating indecision at some point. And yeah, I've been in that. I've been in a great karmic battle. A karmic battle. And in the past couple of weeks, I don't think I've ever felt quite so lost, or quite so found, and then lost, and then found. But the way-seeking mind story isn't about losing or finding. It's about way-seeking. And that's something that I can speak to in my experience. So for purposes of brevity and entertainment value, I'm going to start this story halfway in the middle, as is my wont, in the middle of my life. But I'll give it a very short backstory. I'm going to start my Bicycle Buddha story from when I moved here to Vancouver from Ontario. But the brief backstory is this, that I come from a long ancient lineage of wandering, argumentative, intellectual, searching Jews who were kicked out of Russia and kicked out of Poland and kicked out of here and out of there, and were always searching for a home and a place to feel grounded. So that is my background. My mother was distant and disappointed, and my father was a daydreaming salesman. I was raised in suburban Toronto, more or less, in North York, in fact, more or less in the middlest of the middle class. So that's the backstory. But by 1991, I'd managed to escape the suburbs, and I was living a mildly bohemian life in downtown Toronto. So I had a sort of okay arts admin job, and I had a pretty good boyfriend, and I was going to punk rock clubs and art parties. I'd been to art school, but mostly I was just kind of drifting along with the current, you know, letting the water pull me down as the days went by. So I felt like I was, in a way, slowly drowning. But when I was living in Toronto, I was trundling around Toronto on my rusty old green Orion's racing bike, trying not to get stuck in the streetcar tracks, which inevitably, if anyone's ever been at King Street in Roncesvalles, eventually you're going to go down, and now and again I did, on the rusty old green Orion's. And I have a brother. I have one sibling, who is my younger brother, Bennett. And Bennett was a really serious bike geek, and he still is, actually. And he was a bike racer. He worked in a bike shop. And as a matter of fact, our father was a bike racer as well. And I have Bennett has a little cup that he won from doing a century race. And we have an old photo of him racing on a single speed bike on gravel track in Toronto. And so bicycling is kind of in our blood. And also salesmanship is in our blood. my brother and I, we call it the white belt and shoes gene. So we have that as well in common. So anyway, my brother was worried about the fact that I was riding around Toronto on this crummy old bike with steel wheels. And so one day he phoned me up and he said, come on, we're going to Mississauga and we're going to get you a bike. So he took me to this warehouse, which was there was a company going out of business, and it was full to the rafters of cardboard boxes full of bikes. And he dug through all the bikes and he pulled out a box for me and he said, "Here, there's your bike, buy it." And I looked inside and it was like this incredible steel classic racing bike with Campagnolo parts on it. It was so sweet, it was tiny, and it was orange. And I said, "I don't like orange." And my brother said, "If you don't buy that bike, you're going to walk back downtown." And it was a long way from Mississauga to downtown. So I threw down $200 and I bought the bike and we took it home and he built that bike for me. And that was the orange rocket bike. And that bike changed my life. That's how I discovered that I had a physical body, because I had been living very much in my head. And I am small and I was a complete loser at gym class. And I never realized that I had physical power. And then I got this bike and I loved riding that bike. I rode the bike to visit a friend of mine in Aurora, Ontario, which is like a couple hours north of Toronto. And that's when I found out that you should carry water when you ride a bike in the summer. I almost died of dehydration. My dad had to come rescue me. But I did it. And so then I decided I'd ride to Kingston, Ontario, and I would camp. And I loaded up the orange rocket bike in crazy ways, and I did that. And then I took the train back, and I was like feeling my power. I had this bicycle. And I was realizing that I had much more in me than I thought I had. So then, for the first time in my life, and far from the last time, I felt the impulse to move, and I had to kind of break this inertia that I was feeling. So I put the bike in a box, and I bought a ticket for on the Greyhound, and I got on the bus, and I moved to Vancouver. Well, actually, I had the bike and two other cardboard boxes sent after I got there, and I unboxed that bike, put it together, and that was my new life here with the orange rocket bike. And I was determined that I was going to go to Emily Carr and I was going to study graphic design. But I was kind of afraid of doing that. And there were all these voices in my head that said, "You're too old, you don't have enough money, you don't know how to do that, you can't do that." And so I decided, okay, I don't know how I came to this idea, but I made a deal with myself. I said, "If you can ride that bicycle to San Francisco, then you can go to Emily Carr. You can do anything if you can do that." And so I said, "Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. And I've never been there. I'm going to ride my bike to San Francisco." So I was getting ready to do that. I was riding around with the orange rocket bike loaded down with everything from my kitchen, all bags of flour and things. I ride it over the bridges, and so I was training. And I was getting closer and closer to the day of leaving, and then I started to get freaked out. And I started, people would look at me and say, you can't ride your bike to San Francisco. You don't know how to fix your bike. And people there in America have guns, and you're by yourself, and you're crazy. So I started getting freaked out. And I almost backed out on it. I almost killed the whole idea. And then I came up with a plan, which was I decided, okay, I'm not going to ride to San Francisco. I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to ride my bike for one day, and I'm going to see what happens. And if I like it, I'm going to ride for another day. And if I like that, I'll ride for another day. So that's what I did. I got on my bike. I let go of the goal. I let go of the destination entirely. And I got on my bike, and I rode for a day. And the next day, I got up and I rode again for another day. And I did this every day. And one thing I really learned on that journey was how much you really need to be content. It was, if you've ever done any bike touring, you know it's like Oriyoki lifestyle, right? You got your pot, you eat your food, you wash your socks and your shorts in the same pot, and you attach them to your bike and they dry in the sun, and that's all you need to be happy and to be mobile. And it'll make a minimalist out of just about anybody. So I did that. I rode day and I rode after another day, and I felt like I was getting close to San Francisco, but I still didn't want to actually, I felt like it would jinx it to say that I'm going there. I never said I'm going there. I told everyone I'm just going for a bike ride for a day. And I still managed. You would think like all I had to do was keep the ocean on my right side, right? But I still managed to go the wrong direction once or twice. Yeah. So I knew I was getting close. I was almost there. And I was in Marin, so I was close. And I followed these cyclists, because I didn't quite know how to get into the city, and I followed them through a tunnel, into a tunnel. I saw these bikers go, and I followed them out the other side, and right in front of me there was the Golden Gate Bridge, and I just went, oh my God, I'm here. And at that moment my bandana flew off into the bay, and it was so windy right there. And I was like, I'm coming back, I'm here, I'm gonna live here. And that's what I made this vow. So anyway, I didn't live there then. I checked it out and I had a great time, and I came back to Vancouver and I went to Emily Carr. I was accepted, actually, because the first time I applied, I didn't get in. But I was accepted, and I did my degree there, and then I launched a graphic design company called Emerald City Design, and I was going to get a job. I knew I was going to have to get some clothes and a portfolio, but then little design jobs kept coming my way for nonprofits and for arts and for alternative transportation, and I never did get a job. And I just created I had a wonderful design partner, and I feel very blessed that we were able to do wonderful work for wonderful clients for many years in graphic design. But the other thing that I was doing at that time was I fell in with the bicycle people, and of course. So I started going to Critical Mass, which was like the last Friday of every month, and it was snowballing and snowballing to the point where in the summer there'd be 3,000 cyclists crossing the Burrard Bridge together, or the Lionsgate Bridge, and it was this amazing experience, and that was for the first time I felt like that was my tribe, and I was connected. And I got shanghaied into producing a little newsletter for the radical bike people at the time, and eventually that just moved into doing city politics and advocacy and environmental work, and being a dinosaur with the Dinosaurs Against Fossil Fuels. We rode around town in dinosaur suits, and it was a fantastic time. And I learned about, I mean, at the time, you know, there was nothing. There were no bike routes. There was nothing. People laughed at us. It was like a joke. And the police would come out to the Critical Mass rides on their motorcycles and shove people off their bikes. And I like, horrible things happened. But what we were doing was celebration as resistance. And that was such a powerful thing for me. The other thing that happened at around the same time is that I got involved with the what was euphemistically known as the intentional dance community, also known as the underground dance, also known as the raver scene. So I was older than most of the people then. I was probably 10 years older than the average. And at first it was all very strange to me. I had to get my head around the difference between house and techno music. And I had to, you know, and I got to understand the rituals and the sacraments and what it means to dance all night. And it's very powerful and it's very primal. And I felt very welcome there, and I started to co-organize events with people. And what really attracted me, I think what was really deep for me, was that there was, and there still is, a very deep spiritual thread running through what people were doing then and what they're still doing now. One time I remember I was getting all ready to go out to an event, and my dear friend and housemate said, "Where are you going?" I said, "Oh, I'm going to a party." And she said, "Oh, you're going to church." And I said, "Yeah, I'm going to church." Those of you who are about, you know, maybe a generation or half a generation older than me, this might sound very familiar to you, because it was a kind of second wave of hippiedom in a way, but a very powerful and a very fascinating time. So I had long multicolored dreadlocks, and I wore sparkly things and a furry tail, and it was exhilarating. And we felt like we were onto something really timeless, and that we could change the world, and we were. And in a lot of ways, we did. And some of those people are still my closest friends. But what I really learned was how to organize, and how to be in council. But there was also a certain amount of grasping involved in that world. There's, without wanting to be judgmental, there was a kind of flakiness to it. People were really reaching for things, and a lot of people got disillusioned and dropped away, and some sank into addiction over time. And a friend of mine jumped off the Lionsgate Bridge, and another one swam out to sea and never came back. So there was an ungroundedness to it as well. However, not surprisingly, at around that time, which would be like just mid-2000s, both my bicycle friends and my dance party friends, who often crisscrossed over, started drifting into various kinds of Buddhism. One day, a dear friend of mine, who I call my faux bro, who is now the father of my near few, he said, his name's Kai, he said, "Hey, I'm going to see a guy talk down at the Vancouver Convention Center. Why don't you come with me?" And so I went with him to the convention center. And there was this big, jolly Asian man, and he was speaking, and his name was Goenka, S.N. Goenka. And he was giving a talk, and it was really interesting because a lot of people in the audience were Chinese, so every sentence that he spoke would be repeated by a translator in Chinese. So every sentence he spoke, there was this time for it to sink into my head. And he talked about things like non-attachment and things like no self, and it wrung my brain like a sponge. I walked out of there going, "What the hell?" And I was kind of angry and kind of messed up, and I was like, "I don't understand any of this, but something in this sounds right." So the hook was kind of in me at that point, and I went to my first Vipassana, my 10-day Buddhist boot camp experience, which, as for many of people, was a doorway for me. Let's see, maybe I'll skip this part. In 2005, I dropped everything and went to, again, I ran away again. I went to Arco Santi in the Arizona High Desert, which is this crazy, crazy urban experiment. And it's beautiful and it's kind of insane. And I was living in a little 8-foot square cube at the foot of a mesa, and there were peacocks roosting on my roof, and there were all kinds of nutty things going on there, but it was beautiful. And I think that's where I had my first major existential crisis, because it was all so strange, and I was in my head, should I stay or should I go, should I stay or should I go. And I tried to leave, and I was waiting for a bus to take me down to the Baja. And the bus was coming, and I saw the bus coming from the other direction, and I realized I had a job to do there. I could make it better for the people that were coming in next. And I got on the other bus, and I went back, and I organized parties for the new people coming in for the workshop, and workshops and things for them, like pinhole camera workshops, and it was better. So that was the first time that I trusted my gut, because I knew I had a job to do. And instead of listening to my brain, I listened to my gut. And I trusted a higher intelligence to take me to the right place. So I went back to Vancouver after that, more events, more parties. I took courses at the Shambhala Center, and I did retreats at Birken Forest Monastery, and I joined DIY Dharma, which is kind of against the stream sitting group. And I did the whole Buddhist smorgasbord, pretty much, except for Zen. I didn't do Zen. That was the one thing. No, I didn't do that one. So the match was striking. It was striking, but it wasn't staying lit. It just wasn't catching. So then in 2009, I had a broken heart, and I went to Cortez Island to visit a friend. I'd never been there before. And of course, I went for a bike ride, and my bike broke down. I left the bike by the side of the road, and I walked, and I wound up at this bizarre Tibetan fantasy called Dorje Ling, which is a Dharma center that had been set up by this man named Kenny, who called himself a failed monk, the babbling Buddha. And he was a great challenge and a great teacher. And I wound up going there, and he was not there. I wound up going there for 6 months and turning it into a meditation hostel, which I don't know if there was such a thing before, but there was at that point. I was lucky to have the guidance of Geshe Yongdong, who is a teacher in the Bon tradition, who's based in Courtney. And he's a beautiful, wonderful young lama. And so I did that. I did that for 2 seasons. But somehow, you know, as much as I love the teachings and I loved all the mandalas and the colors, I think more than anything, the aesthetic just wasn't really mine, I think. So I was sitting there one day and I Googled up engaged Buddhism. And Upaya Zen Center came up on the screen in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And I looked at it and I said, really? I'm going there. And I applied to be a resident, and I was accepted to be a resident at Upaya. And then I thought, well, you know, I should go to a Zendo and see what it looks like. I mean, I've heard there's a lot of bowing and stuff, but I never even set foot in a Zendo at that point. But I actually didn't get around to it. I just showed up at the door in Santa Fe. And as soon as I got there, I knew that was it. That's right. This feels right. So, and the day that I got there, Roshi Joan Halifax, who runs the Upaya Center, was there. And she was, as she usually is, madly between here and there. And she was on her way to Nepal. And she just said, good to meet you. And she looked in my eyes and she said, keep your practice strong. She ran off. So, and I didn't see her for months. But that was enough. And when I came back from Upaya, I was desperate for work. And I had a friend who ran a bike store. And you would think that I know something about bicycles, but I actually I didn't know anything about the physical mechanics of bikes or about the retail industry of bikes or anything like that. But this friend of mine ran a bike store, and he said, why don't you come and work in my store? So I did. So there was me and 26 men, and it was a real ego smackdown for me, because here I was a 48-year-old woman. I knew really nothing about bikes, but I knew about people, which is why my friend had asked me to work there. And it was hard, and it was dirty, and it was low-paying, and but it was real service, and I was helping people. And I thought, you know, well, if I have this gene, if the white belt and shoes gene, if I'm going to sell something, I might as well sell freedom. And I really enjoyed it. Some moments I felt like I was rising to my highest calling, selling inner tubes. And that was also the time when I hooked up with Mountain Rain when I came back, thanks to Marley, who was at Upaya and told me about Mountain Rain. And I was lucky to be able to sit in the old Zendo above the subway shop on Fraser Street just before we moved here. So I got to feel that transition and that very incredible time. And in 2013, I went back to Upaya again to do Jukai, which is to take the precepts. It's this. And I was given the name by Roshi Joan of Roshan, which means dewdrop mind. And I think of it as, I translate it as gumdrop mind most of the time, because I have those rare moments of clarity, but they are rare and wonderful. When I did Jukai, it really took me by surprise, I have to say, because once I made this rakusu, before that point, I just felt like I was doing it, and then now I feel like I'm wearing it, and I am it, and it is me. Yeah. So... After that point, most days I actually sat, and most days I actually still do sit. So I think the match is finally lit, and it's sticking. Last year, I finally completed the journey of the orange rocket bike. With the encouragement of Kate and Michael, I went to San Francisco Zen Center for 6 months, and it was a meet the family trip, and I got to be on sort of intimate terms with my great-great-grandpa, Shunryu. I came back from San Francisco, but I have to tell you that I have been back for a year now, and it's been a slog. It's been a tough year. The years of living the monk's life, my resume was a pretty tattered robe. And so I was cleaning houses, I was doing anything I could, I found myself for a couple of days spending 8 hours at a stretch in a dungeon in Brentwood Mall, gluing caps onto Christmas balls. And I was wondering, am I ever going to get on my feet again? And just when things seemed, the fog seemed so thick and impenetrable, finally things started to move for me in a few months ago, I started to get my feet under me, and I started to get some interesting jobs, some writing jobs, and organizing jobs, and learning some new skills, podcasting, things like that. And to my amazement, I was offered work at the very best bicycle stores in town. This is my little promo moment. It's called Side Saddle Bikes, and the slogan is "Ride how you like how you ride." And it's a women-focused bike store, but we also serve men. And so I was really happy with that. And I wish I could say that all my days of running away and my bouts of debilitating indecision are over, but they're not. This is my ancient twisted karma. A few weeks ago, I got offered a summer job on a faraway island. And it was so sparkly and so seductive and sounded really fantastic, and I'm sure that it was. And my old habits kicked right in, you know. The temptation to jump at that shiny new thing and the glittering novelty, the distraction. To be honest, I felt this identification of feeling like what it's like to be an addict in withdrawal, with Mara the tempter appearing over my shoulder, offering me an easy getaway, a quick high. Just go down to the corner, throw down your $10, everything will be okay. Just go away for the summer, have fun, just when things are starting to come together. But my gut knows, even if my brain isn't sure, that there's a time to stay put and stay the course. Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go? And so I almost ran away again, following that pattern of avoidance and procrastination, adventure. And there was a time when that strategy served me well, but this time didn't feel like it was. So I turned it down, and I fought it, and I turned down that job. But it was not easy. But this time, I say, I see you, Mara. This time I'm not running away, I'm staying put. And when I was in the midst of this horrific whiplash flip-flopping that takes hold of me, I was bemoaning to Michael, and he said to me, do you remember your lineage book that you made when you were at Upaya? I'll put this in the back and you can look at it afterwards. He said, was your path a straight line? And this is what I drew to as part of my Jukai assignment. The path is not a straight line. The path is full of twists and turns. I'll put this in the kitchen and you can look. But yeah, that was the story. It all goes back together. Not in a straight line. It is a long and curving path. And so still, during those long and sleepless nights, I remember this phrase again from the Harmony of Difference and Equality. If you don't understand the way right before you, how will you know the path as you walk? Progress is not a matter of near or far, but if you're confused, mountains and rivers block your way. I do get confused. I still get confused. The way is so mysterious. My God, it is mysterious. And the period of indecision, as many of you will know, is excruciating. There's so much I don't know, but I do know this. When the mountain rises up before me to block my way, all I need to do is throw her into low gear and keep on riding. One pedal stroke at a time, just one stroke at a time. And when the river washes out the road in front of me, as it does, I will link arms with my Sangha and we'll help each other to cross it. The way is right before me, and the path is right here. This is my path.
Thank you, Roshan.